Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm your host, Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. We've had an incredibly busy couple of weeks around here. Everything is hitting us all at once. The Truth About Vintage Amps podcast just had their millionth download. If you have not checked out The Truth About Vintage Amps, I co-host it along with amp tech Skip Simmons. It's a great show where we field all of your questions about tube amps. We sometimes talk about parenting and cooking and life. It's a lot of fun. It comes out twice a month. Go tune in if you haven't yet. You might find yourself learning about tube amps, even if you had no desire to. We also have our new 53rd issue of the magazine going off to press in just a few days here. If you have not subscribed to our magazine yet, now is a great time to lock in your copy. Our copies do sell out. 53rd issue is one of my favorite, most eclectic, most interesting issues to date. The history of the Gibson L5. Ben Harper's in that issue. We've got a story on Kate Wolf and her guitar and so much more. Go to fretboardjournal.com, click on the subscribe button. So I feel like I'm just recovering from the Fretboard Summit that took place in August in Chicago. We have another summit happening August 22nd to 24th in 2024. And I am ecstatic to share with you this interview that I did with one of my Airbnb roommates, Adam Levy. Adam has a new jazz trio record out called Spry. I asked him all about that. He also has a brand new book out. It just came out literally today called String Theories, Tips, Challenges, and Reflections for the Lifelong Guitarist. Adam co-wrote this with my other Airbnb roommate, Ethan Sherman. They gave me a copy in Chicago. I was floored by it. This book and Cameron Noller's Guitars Have Feelings 2 book are two quote-unquote guitar instruction books that have crossed my desk this year that have blown my mind. They don't go deep into theory. You don't need to be a pro-level player to appreciate these tips and insights. And what Adam and Ethan have done with String Theories is just so cool. I wanted to talk to him about that. I wanted to talk to him about Spry. We went on a trip down memory lane. I got to talk about my old fascination with some of the San Francisco jazz scene and so much more. A great chat with somebody who is one of my favorite people in the music industry. I think after this chat, you will understand why folks like Norah Jones and Tracy Chapman turn to Adam when they need a guitarist, because he's just such an incredible player and incredibly gifted at what he does, but also just a great presence and a great person to be around. So I hope you enjoy this chat. Again, String Theories is out now. I'm going to include a link in the show notes, as is Spry, Adam's new trio record. Adam's had a busy couple of months here. As always, the Fretboard Journal is brought to you by a handful of sponsors who get what we do and love connecting with you all, our community. Peghead Nation, one of the great instruction portals around, is offering you your first month free or $20 off of an annual subscription by using the promo code FRETBOARD when you check out. So many incredible players from our greater community, including a lot of Fretboard Summit alums, are teaching on Peghead Nation right now. It's super cool. Seattle's Mike and Mike's Guitar Bar is sponsoring the podcast once again. An incredible vintage instrument store, acoustics, electrics, amps, keyboards, you name it, they have it all. It's right here in Seattle, Washington. If you cannot make the trek to Seattle, go to their Instagram page or go to their website, MM Guitar Bar, and see what all the fuss is about. This is a truly cool store with a lot of energy behind it. We are also brought to you by our friends at Stringjoy Strings. You can get 10% off of your first order at stringjoy.com with the promo code FRETBOARD. I've been getting rave reviews from podcast listeners who decided to take the Stringjoy challenge and buy a set of strings, and they're all loving them, and I think you will as well. And then last but not least, Native Instruments is offering you a discount. Go to native-instruments.com and use the code RUIN10, and you will get 10% off of your software purchase. Isotope is also offering 10% off of their software with the discount code FRET10. I'll include the links to all this stuff in the show notes. You don't need to write this stuff down. The takeaway, though, is some great software and plugins available at a great price just for you all Fretboard Journal podcast listeners. All right, I'm not going to waste any more of your time. This is my conversation with Adam Levy about his new record, Spry, one of my favorite chats we've done all year. Hope you enjoy it. Adam Levy, thanks for being on the Fretboard Journal podcast.
Thanks, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Also an excellent roommate, I might add. We just shared an Airbnb with a few other friends at the Fretboard Summit. You're great.
thanks. That was really easy. When I started to think about it, I was telling my wife, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to be sharing a house. There's going to be five dudes in a house.
I know.
I was like, oh, wow. What have I got myself into? But yeah, it was very easy and very fun. And yeah, very like super considerate people, but also fun people and easy people. That worked out great.
Yeah. And much to the landlord's dismay, at least I wasn't there much. I was there for like an hour over the course of the whole weekend, which was kind of sad, but.
Yeah.
The landlord really wanted to meet the tenants of her Airbnb. It was quite a saga. Anyways, Adam, I've been thinking about, I mean, you have a new record out. We're going to talk about that. You have this incredible book project. You are, I will say, sadly, one of my favorite writers, because you don't do any more writing for guitar magazines, but you've written some of the best pieces we've ever published in our history. And I'm super appreciative of that. But I think the thing that struck me hanging out with you for 3 days at the Fretboard Summit was watching you listen. And watching you, and I know this is a big part of the book that you just did with Ethan, watching you play amongst other high caliber players and inserting yourself when tastefully and needed, but also just holding back and listening. And it's an art form, and it's why you're such an in-demand musician, I imagine. It's because you are an incredible listener. And it was like a masterclass of watching that. And I guess my first question is, did that just come naturally to you, or have you been honing that skill for decades?
Sorry, what were we saying? No. Couldn't resist.
Yeah.
It's something that I didn't start to appreciate was a thing until, you know, maybe the last decade or so. But I think it must be something that I was leaning towards from early on, because, like, when I was at music school, a lot of the classes that I mean, outside of the curriculum that I was, you know, the classes I was in, where teachers would kind of grab me to, oh, hey, can you come in and be part of this ensemble class? Most often it was, you know, a class with a singer where they needed somebody who could be supportive of a singer and be part of, have that kind of temperament in a, you know, the school was full of people who could take solos and do kind of guitar player stuff. But looking back, and then after music school, I moved up to the Bay Area, and most of the, you know, when you're a new person in a new town, you have to figure out what your strengths are so that you can introduce yourself on your strengths. And that, combined with people pay attention and they figure out whatever you say, they're going to figure out what your strengths are anyway. And a lot of the stuff that I got called to do was either like kind of intimate listening situations, duos, trios, or sometimes being the like color commentator in a singer-songwriter band. Like, they didn't need Don Felder to step up and play, you know, hot shit rock bluesy rock guitar solos. They needed more something that would kind of just be part of the sound and the music and be complimentary. So all this just to say is, it wasn't something where I had an aha moment and decided I'm going to be the listening guitar player and that's my brand or whatever. But just, I must have been doing it because that's mostly the calls that I've gotten to do. And just little by little, I've kind of figured it out myself, like, oh, I guess that must be what I do, or what, you know, what it is.
Yeah. You grew up in the greater Los Angeles area, Encino, right?
Well, I was born there.
Okay.
We moved to another suburb called Reseda when I was, I don't know, 5 or 6. And then we moved out to Thousand Oaks when I was maybe 10 or 11, which is just outside of LA, but some people would say still the greater Los Angeles area.
And I'm sure it was more bucolic back then than it is now, as is almost every suburb in greater America. But did you grow up surrounded by jazz music, surrounded by instrumental music, or were you listening to rock and roll and trying to shred like a lot of people were when they were young guitarists?
Really, yes to all of that. I was surrounded by jazz music because my grandfather was a piano player, worked in television, wrote music for some variety shows on TV in the 60s. And he didn't think of himself as a jazz musician. He really wasn't an improviser, which is a big part of what jazz is improvisation. But another part of what jazz is just knowing the songs from the Great American Songbook, you know, the Gershwin and Cole Porter and Irving Berlin. And so he knew all those songs that Miles Davis would record, but he knew them as just the popular music of his youth. He didn't think of them as vehicles for making new, you know, for improvising. So in a way, he influenced me because the music that he loved, I saw all the same song titles on the backs of, you know, classic jazz recordings. And also the guys that he would hire for, like, he was often the musical director for whatever TV show he was working on. And the guys he would hire, now those were jazz guys. Like the guitar player that he always hired for sessions was a guy named Jimmy Weibel, who was very much a jazz guy. He often had Red Callender on bass, who had played with Charlie Parker, like was a legit bebop era musician, and on and on. Like, so anytime I would go to a recording session or a TV taping with him, those guys were jazz guys. So I got to meet some of those guys and saw how they were in the world and how they navigated the recording studio environment. And also back at home, my stepdad was really into jazz. He loved Benny Goodman and a band called the Crusaders, which oftentimes had Larry Carlton playing guitar. So I was exposed to a lot of jazz in that way, but also because it was Los Angeles and it was I was in high school in the early 80s. And shred was still in full swing. You know, Van Halen was still, you know, in their first incarnation and making records. And so rock music had real shredding in it. And in the more jazz world, you had people like Alan Holdsworth or John McLaughlin or, you know, just Al Di Meola. Shredding was in its peak, and I was young and impressionable, and it was Los Angeles where you had Musicians Institute, where people would come from all over the world to study with, you know, teachers who would teach you how to shred. So I was around all of it. I was around shred and I was around rock. When I was old enough, I would try to go to hear bands on Sunset Strip, and that stuff was still happening, you know, the kind of hair metal bands like Poison that was the peak of all of that. So it was an interesting time to grow up and play guitar and then for some reason decide not to really go that way, you know?
Yeah. Was your grandfather taking you to these sessions because he saw that you had the music bug, or was this almost just like babysitting? Or both?
I think it was both. You know, my mom for several years was a single mom. Mm-hmm. And so I did spend a lot of time at my grandparents' house. And sometimes my grandfather would take me to work, I think partly as babysitting. Okay. But because I did get the music bug, but it was a little bit later. I didn't, like, I was already excited about music, but when he was taking me to sessions, I was just old enough to sit still and keep my mouth shut, which is very necessary in a recording studio environment. So it was like just, you know, I might have been 7 or 8 and I could behave at least, you know, while the red light was on, I could behave. And I hadn't really started playing, but he kept bringing me, and eventually it became more that. Like, I remember in the late 70s, John Denver did a Christmas record with the Muppets.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And then they decided to make a TV show out of it. The album came first, and then they decided, oh, this is a thing. Let's make a TV show. And he brought me to the taping of that, which had, you know, Hal Blaine was the drummer, who's a, you know, Wrecking Crew, famous yeah. studio drummer. I want to say James Burton was on that session, which would not have been the norm for my grandfather, but might have been a choice from John Denver's team, you know, to have somebody like that on the session. So it was sort of a hybrid of my grandfather's first choice, you know, regular hired guys, and also thinking of it more like a record. My grandfather didn't make records. Like, he was specifically working in television. And so people sometimes ask me, like, oh, well, he must have, you know, worked with all the, you know, the famous studio players that we think of, the Wrecking Crew guys. Sure. But he more had his own Wrecking Crew that was specifically suited to the kinds of things he was doing, you know.
That's really cool. And were you old enough to observe him sort of being a music director in addition to just meeting all these cast of characters? Yeah.
Yeah. The first session that I did as a professional was in 86. He hired me to play on a session, and that was when I really saw it, because, I mean,
yeah,
I wasn't there to be a grandson at that time. I was there to do the work. It was so intimidating. The first guitar chair was Lawrence Juber. Do you know him?
Of course.
Yeah. So he was the first chair. So he had all the heavy lifting. And then I just had, you know, some strumming and some triads, and wasn't that hard. But emotionally, it was just like everybody was such a grown up. And I was like, you know, 17 or 18 or something. And no, I take that back. I might have been 19 or 20. But I could read music. I had gone to music school. Musically, I was totally up for it. But just for all the years he had been taking me to sessions, when suddenly I'm in, you know, not on the sidelines, but I'm actually in the pit, and time is money, and everybody's got, you know, it was very different. I'm getting a little bit like clammy palms just thinking about it now, all these years later. But I appreciated that he did that. I think at that time he was wanting to kind of pass the baton to me. And he was already 70 and I was coming on 20. And he was ready to retire and hand it off to me.
Was that ever discussed, or was it all no?
No.
Yeah. What a gift. How cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
You could have gone to the Shred Academy and become a rocker. And at some point, and my chronology is probably way off, but at some point you took a different route. And I know you took lessons from Ted Green, right?
That's right.
Was that just what was speaking to you?
Yeah, it was. And I you know, I didn't connect the dots until you did just now. But I think to whatever extent I'm a good listener and I kind of like wait to see what's happening before I just start shredding. Ted Green as a teacher was very much a really good listener. You know, I've seen teachers who just, here's my curriculum. We're going to start on page one. You know, maybe if you're really advanced, we'll start on page 12, but we're going to start there. And then we're just going to go through my book and you're going to learn things my way. And that's how it is. And Ted wasn't that way at all. He really taught each person right where they were, mm-hmm. and had a real gift for sussing that out and then help, you know, kind of seeing, like, you know, there's a sort of trope of an employer asking you what your 5-year plan is. Mm-hmm. Like Ted could very quickly, you know, by just hanging out with you for 5 minutes and maybe playing a little bit, he could see what your 5-year plan could be, like a really good 5-year plan for you. And he'd be thinking, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 lessons ahead of, oh, and then this would be cool. But it wasn't just the same old stuff for everybody. He had created tons of handouts already, but also as you were sitting there, sometimes he would just write something out specifically for you or pull something out of a file cabinet and put notes. He had one of those 4-color pens, ballpoint pens with like the mm-hmm. red, the green, and he would just like really get in there and make specific stuff that was for you. So I think studying with Ted, if anything, taught me how to be a teacher as much as it taught me how to be a guitar player. You know, the things that I hear in my playing still that I got from Ted is like touch stuff, just like how you know, some of the neck vibrato stuff and mm-hmm. Maybe playing with the amp a little hotter than you might think you need, but then using a lighter touch rather than, you know, turn the amp to 2 and play hard. He might turn the amp to 4 and play light, which gives you much more dynamic range and more of a kind of more envelope, more ways to shape the mm-hmm. note, which is what he was so great at. So what I learned from him wasn't like crazy chord voicings or, you know, the things you might expect, but just more stuff about how to make the guitar sound rich and full and beautiful. And you know, he got me to not use a pick so much and play more finger style. That's definitely something I got from Ted.
Mm-hmm. How'd you find him?
Huh. He had a very unusual system. I've never heard of another teacher who has done this. He had a no cancellation policy. So what he did was he had like a few days a week that he taught and a certain preset hours. And pretty much it was the same every week. Tuesday at 10 o'clock is Danny. And then Tuesday at 11 o'clock is Susan. And then at 12:30, you know, it's like it was just was what it was because he didn't want to deal with the administrative stuff of it. Mm-hmm. That I recall, he didn't even have an answering machine. So often you'd call him and you wouldn't, not only would you not get him, you wouldn't be able to even leave a message. It's just good luck. So it made it tricky to get a lesson with him. But because of his no cancellation, one of the sort of, if you got into the fine print of his no cancellation policy is if you were one of those lucky people who had a weekly lesson with Ted, if you had to miss one, you could send a friend instead. And you didn't even really have to tell Ted, you know, the friend would just show up and say, oh, I'm here, you know, it's Steve's time, but I'm here for Steve. And that way Ted didn't have to do any of the admin of rescheduling and all that stuff. That's a pain in the neck when you're teaching. And so the first lesson I got with Ted was because my friend Steve Gutai, who was a regular weekly, you know, serious TED student, had to miss a lesson. And he was a buddy of mine. He's like, hey, man, how would you like to take a lesson with Ted Green? You know, I might have been 17 or something. I was still a kid. I was like, yes, great. Where do I go? What time? And, you know, I drove out to Encino. He lived in Encino. At this time, we had already moved out. We were living in Thousand Oaks, California. It was not terribly far, but I drove to Encino and I had this one amazing lesson with Ted. It just blew my mind. And then like a year or so later, I wanted to see if I could take another lesson. And I just looked him up in the phone book. I mean, he was just listed in the white pages in Encino. And I called him up and I reminded him, I got him on the phone and I reminded him, I came like a year ago and, you know, I was subbing for Steve, and he remembered everything we talked about. It was really a trip.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then got a slot.
And I got a slot and I studied with him for a while before I left the LA area in 89. Yeah.
So no cancellation policy. If you did cancel, you lost your slot?
No, it wasn't like that. Sorry. Okay. What I mean is if you just cold didn't show up, that was fine by Ted. You had to pay for it.
Okay.
So your options are three. Show up.
Yeah.
Don't show up and forfeit the money or send a sub.
Okay. All right. And what got you to the Bay Area?
My girlfriend at the time, who was my childhood sweetheart, we had been friends since we were little tiny kids. She had gotten accepted to school at UC Davis, which is kind of near Sacramento. And, I didn't exactly want to leave Los Angeles. Things were just kind of starting to happen. I'd been out of music school for a few years and I was kind of figuring it out. I mean, one of the downsides of having kind of a slow, I'm not a go-getter, you know, so that like the downside of what you observed of like how I play and how I play with other people, it also affects my professional life. So I'm not somebody like right out of music school, I wasn't like banging on doors and, you know, crashing people's gigs and like just going everywhere and like inserting myself into every musical situation in a hustly kind of way. I was more kind of like taking a little bit of a wait and see approach, which when you're right out of music school, you have to be more of a go-getter than I was. So 3 years after I had graduated Dick Grove, I was still kind of figuring it out. And then my girlfriend at the time got accepted to school and I wanted to stay with her. That, even though ultimately we didn't stay together, that felt like a more stable part of my life than anything that was happening for me musically. And I thought it would be good to shake it up. I didn't know that much about the San Francisco music scene, to be honest. It wasn't like, oh, this will be great because so-and-so is there or, you know, this producer is there or any. I didn't really know any of that stuff. But it wound up being good for me because as a stranger, like in LA, part of the thing is it's like, well, I'm from here. I know some people. It'll work out. You know, it's sunny every day and this is going to be okay. I got to San Francisco. I didn't know anybody. I immediately had to get a job. I started working, doing advertising at the local independent paper, the SF Bay Guardian. But I was going out to jam sessions and I got actually a lot more hustle in me there than I ever had in LA because I knew in San Francisco, if I didn't do that, really, literally nothing would happen because nobody had any idea who I was or what I was doing. So I got a lot pushier, not pushy isn't the word, but a lot more proactive. And that proved to be helpful as it turns out.
I mean, I don't know, this predates my visits there, but like in Los Angeles, I mean, you certainly had like Nels Klein and his brother and some jazzy stuff going on in the fringes, but I remember the Bay Area being this insane mecca of eclectic, interesting music. And that was when Amoeba Records was only in Berkeley. And I mean, that was a treasure trove. And I'm sure there was at that time, pre.com, kind of a thriving art scene.
It was incredible. I lived there roughly 89 to 99. In part of that time, I actually had moved to New York and then moved back, but basically 89 to 99. And it's exactly that. It what you said, like there was, in a way, there was a holdover from some of the earlier kind of jazz bohemia. So there were some, you know, legit, you know, Tony Williams was living there and, you know, giving drum lessons. I knew people that were taking, if people don't know who Tony Williams was, he, you know, he played drums with Miles Davis at an important phase of Miles's career and, you know, groundbreaking drummer. And he was advertising in the local paper offering, you know, so you have these like living legends of jazz who are on the scene. And then you had more kind of avant-garde artists and everywhere in between, you know, the Bay Area. That's where I met Ben Goldberg, who's an incredible clarinetist. I actually got to know Bill Frisell a little bit because his managers, Lee Townsend and Phyllis Oyama, lived in Berkeley, and I got to know them. And yeah, there was a thriving, it was just a beautiful time. There's like in between the like kind of tail end of the old San Francisco bohemia, Cafe Trieste, kind of, you know, North Beach, historic San Francisco jazz, and then this kind of new wave of up-and-comers. And the dot-com, actually the first dot-com wave, the more kind of venture, like, you know, whatever dot-com, just, you know, they didn't even, nobody really even understood what the internet was, but it was just like, yeah, or murmur.com, and they could generate some venture capital. And that proved to be great for a little while in San Francisco because young people had disposable income. It wasn't Google money yet. It wasn't, you know, Facebook money. It was just a cool time when young people wanted to go out and hear live music and sip cocktails. And it didn't feel like such an us and them divide the way that it probably does now. If you're playing a little jazz gig and the person at, you know, at the bar is, you know, has some high tech job and is making tons of money. And also there were just, people weren't on their screens then. They were just listening to music, and it was great. You could work as a guitar player. I can't remember a period in my life when I was playing as frequently as just as far as how many days a week I was on a bandstand somewhere making music. Some, you know, like that was a really incredible time work-wise and creative-wise. You had Jenny Scheinman, this great violinist who people might know, and Todd Sickafoos, great bass player, composer who was around. Chuck Prophet, incredible singer-songwriter. These were the folks that were around. It was a really inspiring time to be a musician, to go out and hear live music. Great blues stuff was happening in North Beach. It was super-duper time, for sure.
I'm realizing most of the stuff we've talked about has been your role as a jazz instrumentalist, but when did you start writing songs and taking on the sort of singer-songwriter hat?
Yeah, that goes forward a little bit. In San Francisco, I wasn't doing that at all. Okay. And I always liked singer-songwriters and often found myself in the bands of singer-songwriters. You know, I played with Dan Hicks for a little while. I played with a songwriter named Susan James, who I don't know if people would know, but she was great. And, but I, I never sang even backup vocals hardly at all. Even like when I played with Tracy Chapman in 95, everyone in the band was a good singer and was totally happy to do oohs and ahs and on stage in the studio, whatever. And I was so shy. I had never been within 3 feet of a microphone, I don't think, and never thought I would. And then in 2002, I think, or three, I was on the road with Norah Jones, and her career had been kind of like small club, small club, small club. And then there was this big uptick, and suddenly we were touring, and then we had a bus. And, you know, we went from playing one show a week around New York to like playing a lot, and then playing a lot, a lot. And in that time, she hadn't really been writing. So at once her first record was finished, a lot of the energy just went into promoting the record and, you know, doing what she could. And so she wasn't writing new songs. And then all of a sudden, when we're playing every night on tour, she was just getting a little bored of singing the same, you know, whatever, 12 or 15 songs that we had in our repertoire. So at one point we were on the road somewhere and on the bus, and just Norah said, it wasn't like, guys, we've got to have a meeting. It wasn't like anything like that. But she just said very casually one day, like, yeah, it'd be great if, you know, if you guys, if you want to write some song, anyone, if anyone wants to write something, I'd love to have some fresh songs so that I don't just sing the same songs every night. And we all were like, cool. You know, I wasn't even thinking of it as like, oh, this is a chance to like, you know, make money or, sure, you know, any kind of like career thing. It was just like, cool, like great singer, needs songs. Let me see what I can do. So I was really into Chris Whitley at that time. He had made this record Dirt Floor.
Yeah, that was just incredible.
The greatest, incredible, yeah, record. And so I thought, you know, maybe I would try to write something in that vein. So I tuned to, I didn't know that he was using open D tuning a lot and open tunings, but I could hear this droney sound at the bottom. I came coming from jazz. I really didn't know anything about open tunings or alternate tunings. So I thought, well, drop D, I can do something with that. And so I wrote this kind of bluesy thing with a little jazzy turnaround, and it's called In the Morning. And you know, I just wrote it and I sang it for Norah, even though I'm not, at that time, I barely could sing. I could at least get the song across to her, like what the gist of it was. And mm-hmm. she was like, yeah, that's really cool. Can you write out the lyrics? Maybe we'll try it at soundcheck. I was like, what? Try it at soundcheck. Okay. And little by little, it became part of our repertoire on tour. And then before too much longer, it was time to make her second record, and she wound up recording it. And I had written another song in that time, and she recorded that song as well, which didn't wind up on the album, but it's called The Moon Song. And if you're like a real Norah Jones completist and have the deluxe whatever edition of her Feels Like Home second record, then you might know this song. It's called The Moon Song. And then I just kept writing from there and finally worked up the courage to start doing my own shows and make my own records. And yeah, but that's where it started.
So your first song that you technically wrote was on like an album that sold hundreds of thousands of copies.
Millions of copies. Her second, yeah. I mean, her first record was mega.
Yeah.
But even her second record sold, I don't know, but yeah.
That's great.
Right. The first song that I wrote. And like, if I saw that in a movie, I would call bullshit on that. I'd be like, that's not how music works.
Yeah.
You know, but that's exactly what happened to me.
Yeah. No, I mean, I worked at Amazon during both those records. So that was a huge record for folks who maybe are younger or who don't realize those were giant records. I mean, that was the best-selling record of the year, at least in my little world at Amazon.
Yeah.
Yeah. You briefly mentioned Tracy Chapman. Was that a Bay Area connection?
Yeah. Somehow, I don't remember all the details, but somehow, basically Charlie Hunter recommended me for that gig. And yeah, that's how that happened. Yeah.
Nice. Was the Bay Area, I mean, a lot of the great legendary guitar magazines are based in the Bay Area. Was that how you ended up becoming a guitar journalist editor?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. So for people that don't know, Guitar Player magazine originally started in Cupertino, which cracks me up that, you know, now people think of Cupertino as, you know, Apple, I guess. Yeah. But first time I ever heard of Cupertino, it was on the masthead of Guitar Player magazine. And then later it moved and it was in San Mateo. And so I knew some of the guys there. I knew Joe Gore just as a guitar player, although he was one of the top guys at Guitar Player in the 90s, early 90s, you know, a great era for Guitar Player magazine. And yeah, long story short, I submitted some pieces to Guitar Player in like 96, just on a kind of freelance basis. They were lesson ideas and they started publishing. There was kind of an open call for a little while. Andy Ellis, who was one of the senior editors there, revamped the lessons section of Guitar Player, where previously there were big name people teaching in the lessons pages, like John Knowles, you know, or Tommy Tedesco had a studio column, Arlen Roth had a column, Larry Coryell had a jazz column. And Andy in the mid 90s revamped all that and just opened it up. And it was an open call for people that wanted to write lessons. And those pages were called sessions. So I wrote up a couple of lessons sessions for the magazine and sent them in. And they published the first one and then they published another one. And after three or four, as it turned out, there was a big turnover at Guitar Player. Three of the big named editors there, Jas Obrecht and Joe Gore and James Rotundi, all left in one fell swoop. And so they needed somebody. And Andy Ellis reached out and said, "Hey, you know, we really like the things you've been writing as a freelancer. Would you ever consider, you know, a full-time gig at the magazine?" And I did. So I worked there for a few years as an associate editor. And then after I left, I continued writing for them. I wasn't on the masthead anymore, but I was still writing pretty regularly for them. And then I started doing some things for Acoustic Guitar magazine, which is also a Bay Area thing. Mm-hmm. Although, I had met some of those guys. I met Taya and Scott just around the scene, I guess. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, the Bay Area, being in the Bay Area did put me in a good position to reach out to those folks and do some work. Yeah. And then I reached out to you at some point, or you reached out to me. I can't remember how we started doing stuff together.
Yeah. So were you, I mean, Guitar Player's always been kind of a melting pot magazine from everything from the shred and metal to the legends, like some of whom were writing columns when you were there. Did you get to witness lots of walkthroughs of the crazy bands doing their Guitar Player interview, or was it a pretty subdued office?
It was a disappointingly subdued office. Okay. Very, you know, we were just in some building in San Mateo that probably the rest of the building was doing, I have no idea what, but we were not very rock and roll. Bands did not come through. Most of the interviews were done off-site, either on the phone, like I'd be in my little office talking to some amazing musician, or we would go to their gig and interview them backstage. And occasionally there was budget to – I never got to do this, but you know, there was a Jeff Beck interview where they actually sent somebody over to London to interview Jeff Beck. I mean, it was funny because, I mean, the interviews that I had were all, I have so many vivid memories of really colorful conversations. I wish I had saved all the cassettes because I was at that time, nothing was really digitized.
Yeah.
This is pre that. So I just had this like rig where you could, I forget how, but hook up a cassette recorder through the phone and record the conversation.
I had one.
So, yeah. So like, you know, I interviewed Hubert Sumlin and I can still hear the sound of his voice in my head. He just was so full of personality. And I interviewed Paul Burleson from the rock and roll trio, the Johnny Burnett Trio. I interviewed, this was just like in my first 6 months there. It was just kind of insane. Like everybody that I could imagine. I interviewed Pat Metheny. I interviewed Paco de Lucia. I got to interview Chris Whitley. And kind of everybody. And then once in a while, they'd send me out to like do a lesson. Like I got to go take a lesson with Jim Hall at Jim Hall's apartment in New York.
Amazing.
You know, right?
Yeah.
I got to go to Sharon Isbin's apartment in New York and do a lesson with her. I got to do a lesson with Kelly Joe Phelps, where I went to his hotel room and he was in New York playing a show. It was him and Bill Frisell and Petra Hayden did a show together.
Wow.
And I remember I went to his hotel. This was when, Tunesmith Retrofit had just come out. So do you know that record?
Mm-hmm.
So it was for that record. And and Andy Summers, I got to go to Andy Summers's place in wherever, Santa Monica or Venice Beach, and like hang out and take a lesson with Andy Summers and write it up. So those were really fun. But as far as like any kind of rock and roll antics inside the guitar player offices, probably the most fun story that I have about that was like, Ray Davies came down for a photo shoot.
Yeah.
And he at that time was doing a solo acoustic tour, like kind of stories and songs tour, and was playing an Ovation. And we were going to put him on the cover of Guitar Player. And the art director looked at Ray Davies and looked at the Ovation. And he was like, no, that's not going to be the cover of Guitar Player magazine. So he frantically went around to all of us, you know, editors in our little offices and was like trying to find like a cool, does anybody have a cool guitar? And then I happen to have this guitar in my office, which is, you know, at that time was my one and only guitar. This is my 1979 ES-335. You know, as far as collectors, you know, we live today in the kind of, you know, age of the golden age of guitar porn. This probably wouldn't seem to be the sexiest guitar you could imagine to put on the cover, but that's what happened. So somewhere in 1998, there's an issue of Guitar Player magazine with Ray Davies on the cover holding my guitar.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did he put up a fight? I mean,
I don't know. I wasn't in the room when that decision was made.
I mean, so I making somebody hold somebody's random guitar, even a cool 335, is sort of a verboten these days. I mean, I would never do that.
Right? Yeah. It is right to be on the cover of a magazine and have the magazine tell you, you know, you can't play your guitar here. Hold this.
Yeah.
Another funny story. Gosh, this. Okay. I don't want to say who this is, but somebody else who was on the cover of Guitar Player magazine, showed up for his photo shoot. They let him play his own guitar.
Okay, good.
He also chose his own clothes, including some jeans that were pretty dang, form fitting.
Okay.
And when they started looking at the photos to get the photo for the cover, was like, man, there's just too much going on here to put this on the cover of the magazine. And so this art director, that he's no longer with us. His name was Rich Leeds, really amazing character. Actually, he was the most rock and roll guy in the building, the art director, not us editors, but the guy who really was like a real star to me was Rich Leeds, the art director. Anyway, he did some tasteful airbrushing or whatever to try to, you know, make it a little more cover friendly, and then sent it to this guy's publicist, kind of figuring that they might not be happy because, you know, he just wasn't sure how they were going to respond. He had toned things down a little bit and sent them that photo for approval. And they came back and said, hey, would you mind toning things down a little bit? And he had already toned things down. So it was, I guess I never saw the original photo, but it must have been pretty
X-rated, you know,
not safe.
Geez.
Yeah, not safe for work situation. But that's just a funny thing that I remember from those days.
In the parallel universe, Christopher Guest does a mockumentary on this. They would come to borrow your jeans. And make that artist exactly. wear your jeans since you had just lent your guitar a month prior.
That's really funny. Yeah.
Adam, you've got, I mean, your entire discography, I'm not just saying this is amazing. I mean, the record, you did the record with Mason a few years ago. It doesn't feel like it was that long ago, but I know it was probably pre-COVID. You have a new record out now, Spry. Talk to me about it. Tell me how it came to be.
Yeah. It's kind of funny how it came to be, which was that just prior to COVID, I had this idea that I wanted to make a solo record. Just because it's something I had never done. And I used to love playing solo. I had a steady, back in my Bay Area days, I had a steady gig at this cafe. And over the years, I've played solo gigs here and there. And just prior to COVID, I had started playing a weekly Sunday solo gig at this bar in LA, this amazing bar called 1642. It's still, to me, the coolest place to play, you know, intimate, small-scale music in LA. And I had started working on some stuff, and I even talked with Joe Henry about, like, how would you feel about producing a solo guitar record for me? And he was like, yeah, let's do it. We had a couple of meetings about it and started to kind of have a direction for it. And then COVID happened, and that just flipped everything on its head, because suddenly the only music I could play was solo guitar. And I got kind of bored and frustrated of it because I was so hungry to... It was like you get this wish, like, oh, I just want to play solo guitar. And then you're trapped on a desert island. You, like, you know, there's a puff of smoke and you're on an island with a guitar and nobody. And you're like, oh, this isn't what I wanted. You know, that's what it felt like. So, you know, I wrote some etudes, which I shared with my students. And I put some singular solo pieces on Bandcamp. So, in a way, I made a solo record that kind of spilled out in pieces over the year or two, that if somebody wanted to, they could stitch together and say, well, here it is. Here's the solo record. You did make it, but it didn't happen that quite the way that I pictured it. It didn't involve Joe Henry. You know, it was just kind of me in my room waiting for the alarms to stop going off outside. And so coming out of that, when things started to open up, I thought, you know, what I really want to do is make a great trio record, which I had never really done. I made a couple of organ trio records with guitar and organ and drums. I made a quartet record with guitar, bass, drums, and violin with Jenny Scheinman. Most of my singing records, or not most, but some of my singing records are guitar, bass, drums, and singing, but I hadn't yet done a record that was instrumental, guitar, upright bass, drums. And I thought, well, I want to do things that I haven't done. I haven't done that. And so I started writing music, and this is kind of how I do a lot of things. I say, I'm just going to write music every day until I have enough music. And that, of course, that lasted like maybe 2 weeks, and then I got distracted. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, well, maybe I can get like one tune a week and that's enough. And eventually I had enough music that it felt like I had a record. I had about, 12 or 15 brand new things. And it felt like maybe 10 or 12 of them could hang together and be a well-rounded record. I didn't want it to just be, it's a tricky thing. Sometimes I like records like where every song is its own thing. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, wow, you know. And then sometimes I like records where you put on that record and the whole thing kind of has a mood, and you're going to spend whatever 30, 40 minutes in that mood with that record when you put it on. And I wanted this record to be more like that. I wanted it to be a mood. And so I gathered the pieces that seemed like they were complementary to that mood, with hopefully just enough variety to keep people moving through the record and not be like, well, did I already hear that song? That sounds like the other song. Like, mm-hmm. it's a delicate thing, and I hopefully got it. And anyway, I recorded with Larry Grenadier, who is of my generation, you know, the best bass player I've ever known or played with. I've known him on and off for 25 years. Not a regular guy that I play music with all the time, but somebody that's been part of my musical life for a long time, because I used to see him play in the Bay Area. That's where he was when I was living there. We're the same age, but he was already playing gigs with the biggest names you could imagine. Mm-hmm. So I've always looked up to him as you know, that guy, even though we're the same age. He was always, anyway, his sound is incredible. The way that he plays the bass, like the other night we played a show and my wife was at the bar. And my wife is not a music person, really. She loves me. I happen to be a musician. So she comes out to shows. She's super supportive. But music isn't the number one thing in her life. And right next to her was our friend Chris Morrissey, who is a great bass player who tours with Norah Jones now and plays with Mark Juliana. He's like a very bright light of new musicians. And he's a bass player, and they're sitting next to each other at the bar. And the way Larry Grenadier plays the bass was really speaking to both of them. Like, he plays in a way that a regular lay person who doesn't know that much about music is like, that guy is incredible. And also Chris Morrissey, whose whole life is about the bass, is sitting there and going, that guy is incredible. And not every musician is like that. You know, some people, you know, do you know what I mean?
I do.
Yeah. He's just very special. And then Kenny Wollison was on drums on this gig, but on the record is Joey Barron, who's almost a generation before me. I met him when he was playing with Bill Frisell. And he's just like a living link in a way to me to another generation. And I wanted to have that be part of the sound of this record as well. And of course, you know, I've been inspired by, like, Julian Lage has been making trio records, and that's great. And, you know, Bill Frisell, every record seems like is a little bit different, but some of my favorite stuff with Bill is when he's playing either duo with Thomas Morgan or trio with either Kenny Wollison and Tony Scher or Rudy Royston and Thomas Morgan. And it's just such a classic sound to me, you know, guitar, bass, and drums. So I tried to write music that would feature the band and not have it be a guitar showcase per se, but just like three is like a really magic number to me, not in romance, but in music. I just think three-piece bands are the best. Like, that's like everything you'd want. So I just tried to write music that would work in that way, and to whatever extent I could kind of play to my strengths and keep it simple. You know, I used just two guitars. I used one electric guitar, one acoustic guitar, and a pretty simple setup. We set up all in one room, no headphones, minimal baffling, no overdubs, no fixes, just honest playing in a room. And that turned out to be the right thing, because when I listen to this record, I really don't think it would sound the same if we were in headphones. I can't imagine the same level of interplay and intimacy.
You write these songs by yourself, and then you finally meet your trio, or you knew them, but you're finally in the same room. How much time was there between here's what I wrote for this next record versus hitting the record button?
In person, almost zero. I had booked 3 days to record 15 songs. And one way I thought about doing it was, okay, day one will just be a rehearsal, and then we can record in jazz. 15 songs in 2 days is totally doable. I wouldn't do that with a pop record, you know, or I mean, just any record that's where they're singing, that sounds pretty ambitious. But in jazz, that's very normal. Mm-hmm. You know, 2 days, you make a record. So that was one thing that I thought in my mind, we'll just do day one, it'll just be a rehearsal. But then I thought, no, I don't want to miss out on getting something that feels fresh. So we should just start playing. And we can always, if we get to day three, we can always re-record something if we didn't get a good take on day one. But I didn't want to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I really thought about day one, like, oh, we don't even have to record, we'll just rehearse. But then anyway, that's neither of those things is what really happened. But in leading up to it, I recorded acoustic guitar demos of everything, because the drummer, Joey Barron, asked me, he's like, can I hear some of this? So I, you know, just took a metronome and my iPhone and my acoustic guitar and recorded some version of all of the tunes. Sometimes with a little explanation, hey, in this section, I think in this section we might do this or do that. Sometimes not. And I put all that in a Dropbox, and I made charts of everything, and I put all that in a Dropbox, and I sent it on to both of the guys, not knowing if they would ever open them up, but at least, okay, here it is. And they both did, actually. Joey told me he'd spent a fair bit of time just, you know, headphones on, brushes, like playing through the music. And I actually did go and get together with Larry. He lives in Kingston, which is a couple hours north of New York City. But then the first day we just started recording, and we got probably four or five keeper takes on the first day. So we just kept moving forward. And by the third day, there wasn't that much left to do, really. Mostly we had a photographer come, so I'm glad for that. There's good photos of the sessions, but we didn't actually make that much music on the third day. We just hung out and had lunch and played a couple tunes and took pictures. And I like to rehearse. If I'd had my druthers, we would have rehearsed. But Joey lives in Berlin, and Larry lives just a couple hours from me, but is on the road all the time. And it's just not the easiest thing to get people together.
Yeah. I love this record. And I also wanted to know, when do you write the song titles? You obviously had fun with it. And I'm like, yeah, I kind of get it. Chalk Sidewalk, you know, but like, does that come before or after?
Both.
Okay.
Both. Sometimes a little phrase will inspire a little word phrase will inspire a musical phrase. There's a song on the record called Second Best, mm-hmm. the name of which, my wife works for a furniture company called Blue Dot, and they have very whimsical names for a lot of their products, you know, and there's a table, I can't remember if it's like an end table or something like that. They have a table in their line called Second Best. And isn't that funny, right?
Yeah.
And so there's a bass line. It goes boom, doom, doom, boom, doom, 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 doom. And in my mind, I'm thinking, second best, second best, second best. There's no more lyrics. It's not like then I've got like, you know, this word document with, you know, words to the whole. It's just that little phrase, second best, inspired that bass line. Boom, doom. Second best, second best. So sometimes that happens where just saying some words out loud feels like it has pulse and melody in it, and that might inspire. Like one of the first bands I ever had when I first started writing original music, this is like in 93, I wrote a song called Lois the Pie Queen because I was living in Oakland and there was this old diner called Lois the Pie Queen. And every time I would say it out loud, it was like, Lois the Pie Queen. Like I could hear this melody to it. So that's a thing I've done for a long time. But the other tunes on the record, the title definitely came later. There's a title called Vermouth, which came out of a conversation I had with the bassist on the record, Larry Grenadier. He loves martinis and he's very particular and about, you know, his how he likes them and the different vermouths and all that. So, because that song is very bass forward, like, it's the second song on the record and the bass is very active in it. I was thinking maybe I would name it after him and Vermouth was a nod to Larry. Sidewalk Chalk. I was out taking a walk in Tacoma actually, and just happened to cross over some, you know, like hopscotch with, you know, some extra flowers and butterflies and stuff. And it looked like it had been like drawn a few days earlier and maybe there had been some rain and maybe somebody rode their bike over it. So it wasn't like fresh, vibrant sidewalk chalk, but it was like, it just felt like there was a story there. So I like to have titles that feel somehow like a short story. And then sometimes stuff just inspires me. There's a song on the record called And They All Sang, which is the title of a collection of Studs Terkel interviews. And again, the melody is kind of, and they all sang. And they all, like you can kind of sing that title along with the melody of the song.
What are you doing on that song, by the way? Is that just you riding the knob?
How so, do you mean?
Just the swelling, the guitar, like what are we hearing? Is that just your fingers?
I think it's just my fingers, yeah. Oh,
okay.
I'm playing my 64 335, there's an overdrive pedal, which I think was the JHS overdrive preamp. And there's a vibrato, there's a Jam Pedals Harmonious Monk kind of doing.
Okay, that's a probably pulse. What I'm, yeah.
Yeah, so there's that, but then like a big part of the way that I think of sound with electric guitar is it's harder to do this for me on acoustic, but just turn the amp up like 15% more than what is appropriate. Mm-hmm. And then play 20% lighter than what you think is appropriate.
It's the Ted Green thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And then exactly that. And then you still have a little room to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so some of the swelling might be what you're hearing could just be the pedal going woo, woo,
yeah.
woo.
Yeah.
And then anything else is just me kind of like, I don't use a volume pedal, but I am thinking kind of that way with my right hand, like how much can I do? And most of the time my guitar is wide open. I might roll it back to 8.5 or 9 or something. But if I'm fiddling with it, it's more like a fidget spinner than it is like a doing something that anyone else would notice.
Okay.
It just takes the edge off of my whatever, you know, I can't say that it's something that other people would sense, but it helps me to have those fidget spinners on the guitar.
I was just thinking, when is some innovative luthier going to put a fidget spinner or a knob that just spins around and does nothing on the top of a guitar? It's a great idea.
Duncan.
It could look like a real knob, but it just spins around in circles like it's broken.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a cat toy for
yeah.
me.
Yeah, you know, exactly. The two drummers that you've mentioned, you know, playing with on this record, Kenny for the live and then Joey for the studio. I don't know that you know this, but I was in the Bay Area a lot when you were there. I was living in Sacramento and probably had some of the many same shows. And that was a period in my life where I was really into jazz. And, you know, I think it went from like Sonic Youth to Sun Ra to John Zorn and then splintered off into all of that stuff. My memory of Joey Barron from 25, 30 years ago was this like powerful, bald, could look like he could kick your ass or smash his hand through the drums at any one moment. And then my memory of Kenny was this kind of wiry, much more subtle, bringing out children's toys, like having fun, maybe could also kick my ass, but a different vibe. When you play these shows with Kenny versus Joey, is there a different vibe and do they kind of take on a different life?
Well, that's so interesting.
Maybe they're totally different now too. I haven't seen either of these guys. I mean, my memory is so old.
It's a really interesting thing that I've been thinking about this week specifically, because just this week in New York, I happened to run into two guys that I hadn't seen. On two separate guys on two separate days that I probably hadn't seen in 20 something years. One guy is a sax player, one guy's a piano player. And it's one thing when you see your friends every day and 20 years go by little, they change. It's another thing. You don't see somebody, you know, between when they're 30 and when they're 50, that's a lot of life, you know? They have the same face, but a different physicality. A lot has happened. So, you know, I don't know if the Joey Barron of today or the Kenny Wallison of today would be the exact same guys that you remember. But, you know, I played with Joey in his band in around 2000. I was in his band for a little while. He had a band called Killer Joey. And what I remember about him then, it's funny that your memory of him is as a tough, because to me, being on stage with him, I just remember this effervescent. He just radiated this kind of pure joy, and I never felt like there's any place else he would rather be than in that moment at the drums with these people on stage, with these people in the audience. Like, this was just like, he could almost like stop the world from spinning for a minute with just like the sheer focus on the present moment. It was really intense. It's just like, this is happening. And I turned to look at him and there'd just be this big smile. And his beat was, if I think of him as a tough, it's just more like his beat is unassailable. There's no force in the world that I am aware of that could stop Joey Barron's beat. You know, it's just an unbelievable thing. And Kenny, as you say, is a more kind of like, it's more kind of live and more whimsical, maybe. But I, in a way, I feel like as years have passed, that I would never confuse the two of them. If this was one of those downbeat blindfold tests, you could not fool me into thinking that one guy was the other. They're very different. But in those general terms that I've been speaking, I feel like they're more similar now than I used to think of them. Kenny also exudes a lot of joy, and also there's a little more toughness in his approach, and Joey is still unflappable, but there's a lot of stuff on our record that's actually pretty delicate. There's one song that didn't make the cut that I'll probably put out sometime as a single. He just played rocks on it. He had two like rocks that you'd find on a beach shore or on a lakefront. And he never picked up sticks or went to cymbal. He played the whole song on two rocks. That was, and that's the kind of thing that he might do. Like he leaves some to your imagination. It's a real magic trick. And actually his hobby is magic. Like when we're not making music, he's rolling a coin between his fingers, or like, you look over, he's in the corner and he's making things appear and disappear. Like he's practicing sleight of hand a lot. Like I don't say magic as a thing that he does like, oh, he's a magician. Like, no, he really is into actual magic and has studied with guys and, you know, hangs out with magicians. But that's also part of what I think he is doing at the Kit. It's a little bit of like misdirection, a little bit of, wait, did I hear what I think I heard? And then on a record, you can actually go back and listen. It's like, oh, he dropped that beat. There's nothing on that beat, but your mind kind of puts something there that's not actually there, you know?
It's the sleight of hand thing.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
Well, the record is incredible. And despite my faded memories of both those drummers, they are both, I mean, they both had a profound impact on me. And I remember Kenny in the new Klezmer trio with Ben Goldberg, who you just talked about a while ago. An incredible rhythm section on this record and the live shows. You, switching gears for a second, you were at our Fretboard Summit with Ethan Sherman, another incredible player and collaborator. And you guys handed me a book. And I started reading it on the plane home, and I was floored by it. It's so cool, and I have all sorts of questions about it, but tell me how this came to be.
Ethan. He started it. Well, I guess I started it because at some point around 2014 or 15, I started making videos on YouTube. I started a channel called Guitar Tips. It was just a kind of spur of the moment thing. I had no idea. Like I couldn't, the what YouTube guitar sphere is today, I could not have imagined then.
Yeah. None of us could.
It was just a way to share some ideas, things that I've learned along the way. And publishing a book seemed like a big ordeal, and uploading stuff to YouTube was kind of like, you know, public access,
yeah,
or something. TV public, if people even know what that is. But yeah, it was like, okay, cool. So I started doing that. No, mm-hmm, no grand plan. No spreadsheets of like, oh, publish this on this date and do like just totally freestyle. But every week I did it, week in, week out. Sometimes there was real lessons. Let me show you this thing on the guitar. Sometimes just think pieces, whatever. And I did it for a long time. And then maybe 5 years ago, I'm jumping forward a little bit in time now. Ethan said to me, you know, maybe there's a book here with your guitar tips, because he had been watching them. And I said, huh. And we both talked about some books that we liked a lot, music books that weren't so much about, you know, put your finger here and do this 10 times and then click the metronome and do it 10 more times in every key. Like, we like those books too, but we had talked about books that were more conceptual. Like, there's a book called Free Play that's about improvisation that's really cool. And Mick Goodrick's book, The Advancing Guitar Player, which does have a lot of musical material, but there's plenty of pages with just stuff to think about. Yeah. And so on. And I was like, well, you really think there's something like that in Guitar Tips? He said, yeah, I think so. So he used the YouTube, there's something in YouTube that will generate the text. It'll like transcribe it. Yeah. And so then he went through some of those and we kind of edited out all the ums and ahs and, you know, tried to get it a little more focused. And then it started to actually look like something that could be a book. He was right. We chose particular things. And then he asked me, you know, hey, would you mind if I wrote a few little essays in here too? You know, so my voice is part of the book. And I said, yeah, of course. And so what the book is some of my guitar tips videos from YouTube turned into book form. Some of Ethan's ideas, and then some things that we worked on together. And yeah, so that's what it is. And it gives you a lot of things where you, like, here's something you could work on today. Here's something that you could work on over the course of a week or a month. And here's something that you could work on over a longer scale of time.
Mm-hmm. You're based in New York now. Ethan's touring the world and mainly in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Was this like a shared Google Doc or something where you guys both would chime in a little bit and edit, add, comment?
In the beginning, when we first started 5 years ago, I was still living in LA.
Okay.
He wasn't quite as busy. If people don't know, like, he's touring with Michael Bublé now. Yeah. And he's also going to be doing a tour coming up with the Waylon Jennies.
Yeah, he's incredible.
And he's incredible and makes his own records. So he wasn't as busy then, and I was still in LA. So we would either get together for coffee or talk on the phone. And even still, there was some Google Dockery back then. But since the pandemic and I moved back to New York in 2020, it's all been remote, back and forth with Google Docs and lots of comments. And, you know, I learned a lot about, I think at one point we went from Google Doc to Adobe because the commenting, we needed a real clear mm-hmm. place to do that. And then we got a proofreader involved and an editor. And the more people that were involved, they all seemed to think that Google Docs were, you know, not what you would really do in a real book, that you that they sold us on Adobe for whatever reason. I'm not sure it matters. But anyway, that's what happened. Sorry.
No, it's called String Theories. We should mention that. I'll include a link in the notes. I love this book. I'm probably like many fretboard journal readers, but not all of them, in that I am a very recreational, you know, you could call me a hack. I'm not a great guitarist. Nobody wants me to tour with them or anything. And sometimes you buy a new guitar book and you're really excited, and it immediately becomes like an academic exercise. And you're like, well, I've already made it this far, and the academics haven't sunk in, so why will they now? Whereas this book was much more thoughtful. It was more about being a thoughtful guitarist over a technician, although a technician certainly would benefit enormously from this book. I don't know. Am I generalizing in a accurate way?
Yeah, I hope all of that's true. Like, we, Ethan and I think in our ways are more on the wallflower end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. But it's not meant to be a book just for other wallflowers. Yeah, we hope that shredders and flat pickers and jazz guitar players and songwriters will all find something in it that that helps take them further down the road, for sure.
Yeah. Well, and so it's one of these great books. You know, I think I said this about Cameron Noller's book on old time backup too, where you don't necessarily have to read it in a linear fashion. It's not like you're in first grade and then you graduate high school on the last page or whatever. You talk about sessions and what you learned from specific recording sessions, which was great. I don't know whether it was you or Ethan, but one of you wrote, like, don't make the mistake of when you flub a note working on a song, you just stop and start from scratch. Like, you wouldn't be able to do that at a cafe gig or a club. Like, you'd have to keep playing. And it's just right. Little kernels like that where I'm like, I'm never going to forget that.
Right. Right. I mean, yeah. If people are listening to this and they happen to have been at the summit, they heard Bill Frisell's incredible story about playing ping pong with his daughter. Yes. And getting to 608.
I've got to figure out a way to put that out as a standalone thing. But yes, it was incredible. I'll never forget it.
Right. I won't forget it either. But also, like, I think the point in the book, I think it was Ethan's thing, is like, on the bandstand, you don't start over. Mm-hmm. Like, if you get to 300 and flub it, you don't start over at zero with the ping pong ball. You know, like, I'm sorry for people who are listening and they're like, what the heck are you talking about?
But Bill Frisell and his daughter had an incredible ping pong rally session that volley, whatever it's called. Yeah. That just went on for a long time. It was amazing.
Right. And there's a beautiful lesson in that. But another lesson is what, you know, when you're on stage, there's no do-overs. Music doesn't have a reverse gear. It only has a forward gear. Yeah, sometimes you can tap the brakes, but music is happening forward. And part of what we do as improvisers is roll forward. It's probably akin to the stuff you would learn if you were taking like a comedy improv workshop or something. It's like how to roll with what's actually happening rather than what you wish was happening or what was planned to happen. Something is happening, and the best thing you can do is roll with what is happening. And the more you try to struggle against any kind of rift between what is happening and what you wish was happening, it tends to make things worse. Mm-hmm. So that's a really important lesson, is to go with what is. But another thing I wanted to mention, because you mentioned Cameron's book, and also earlier we were talking about Ted Green, like, our book is not meant, it's great if you want to start at the beginning and go forward. But as Jason said, you can jump around And I can tell you, like, some of my favorite parts of my favorite music books are somewhere in the middle. There's a part of Ted Green has a book called Modern Chord Progressions. And I think the best part, which I would pay full value for if there was only this one chapter, but it doesn't, he doesn't even get there till page 49. And it has to do with the cycle of fourths. And he gives you little nuggets and you have to like finish the, you know, like he gives you two starter chords and you have to figure out the rest. It's like a puzzle book in a way. And, but you have to get to page 49 before that even happens. And in Cameron's book, somewhere in like the 60 page mark or something, there's this section where he shows you how to, he talks about this thing called the Georgia clave, which is this two bar accompaniment pattern. And he shows you how to play it in all five kind of cage. Like here's the C form, here's the A form, here's the G form, here's D with a high form. And then here's D if you want to go down low. So there's like five and a half or six variations on this really simple thing. And everything leading up to that, I loved. But when I got to those two, like that stayed open on my music stand for a couple of weeks. And I would just go back to it. It's the simplest thing. But I thought that was like the most valuable part of the book. There might be more stuff after that. That's the part where I just was like, oh, shit, this is what this book is all about right here. But it's not on page one or 10 or 20 or 30 or 40. It's really so. I hope people will look at our book the same way, like start somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's super cool. At the Fretboard Summit, we had a magical weekend. We're going to be sharing a lot from it. So people are going to be clobbered over the head with Fretboard Summit coverage, but you and Ethan did a late night jam that was jaw-dropping. It was so cool. And again, proof that, you know, as talented as you are as a player, like your listening was just a masterclass. Joey Landreth started and he sang a song about his daughter, and I can't remember what that's called, but someone will tell me. And then you reminded us all that you have a great voice singing with I Can Promise You That. Are you writing any song? We're going to hear you sing again.
That's a good question.
Do you hate it? Do you love it?
I love it.
Okay.
I love it. For some reason that I don't even want to say it's writer's block because it doesn't feel like that, but I just haven't been writing songs with words in the past couple years. I have been really focused on instrumental music. I mean, I wouldn't call it writer's block because actually I've written a ton of music in the last 3 years, but not so much with words. The last singing record that I made was called Accidental Courage, and that's already 5 or 6 years old. And the only lyric writing I've done in the past few years has been collaborative, where a friend of mine will say, hey, come over, let's write a song. But I'm not, for whatever reason, keeping notebooks and, being in the practice of it. Part of me really wishes that I was. I keep kind of like a few months ago, I got together with a really great musician in Brooklyn named Jason Ewald and took a songwriting lesson with him. And I've gotten together a couple times with my friend Jim Keller. I don't know if you know Jim. Incredible songwriter. Was in the Bay Area probably even before you and I were, but was part of this band Tommy Two Tone, 8675309. That was where Jim came out of. But also, like, he was around the Bay Area, like when Huey Lewis and the News were kind of just starting out, and they were just kicking around and writing songs. And so he's a we get together and work on stuff. So it's not like I haven't been writing songs, but not with the same. For me, when I'm writing, I get into a rhythm where it's every week. When I was living in LA, I was part of this Monday night songwriting group with my friend Anna Vogelzang. And we got people together every Monday bringing in new songs. And it was a really fertile, fun, incredible thing. That was probably like the last time I was doing a lot of writing. And that was maybe 5 years ago. And I can't really explain it. I hope to get back to it. I still love words. I still love lyrics. I love poetry and imagery and meter and all the stuff that I've always loved. Just for whatever reason, I've been focused on the music part of music.
Yeah, that's all right. It's all great. Adam, thank you. Thank you for coming to the summit. Thank you for talking to us. Thank you for this book that I love. It's your treasure.
Oh, I'm so glad. Thanks for spending time with me today. Thanks for this conversation.
All right. That was my chat with Adam Levy about Spry and about the new book. Podcast at fretboardjournal.com is how you can get a hold of me. And next week's episode will be TJ Thompson and Mark Stutman live from the Fretboard Summit. I think you guys will love it.